the edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Rod. Sorry I didn't hit your button there on time.
You know, people have been trying to mute me for years.
There you go.
All right, so we're going to start our program this morning. We're going to speak with Dr. Sherry Gleed. She's the dean of NYU's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. She's going to be giving her perspective on the implications of the Big Beautiful Bill on Medicaid. It's the first of a two-part series that we like to call Both Sides Now. We'll be hearing from Dr. Gleed this week, and next week we're going to hear probably a pretty different perspective on the issue from Kevin Corinth of the American Enterprise Institute.
And after Sherry Gleed, we'll hear from Bryn Ramjoy from My529, that's Utah's college savings provider, about the detail of this top 529 plan in the country. Then we're joined by Jake Wolf of Warehouse Motor Club to learn about the club and maybe get some stories from their Colorado Adventure on Ice. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
On July 4th, President Trump signed the reconciliation package known as the One Big Beautiful Bill. The bill has widespread effects on the federal budget, including extending many of the 2017 tax rates that were set to expire and dramatically affecting federal spending on health care. Much of the health care savings from current projections comes from some big changes to Medicaid. On the phone to help us understand the nature of the changes and their implications is Professor Sherry Gleed, the dean of New York University's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Okay, Dr. Gleed, let's start with some Medicaid 101. What is the stated purpose of the program, and how has it traditionally functioned?
So Medicaid is sort of an accidental program. It got started at the same time that Medicare did in the mid-1960s in the Johnson administration. It's actually picking up on the fact that historically in English-speaking countries, states and localities have had responsibility for providing health care to indigent people, deserving indigent people. And in 1965, the federal government picked up a portion of those state responsibilities, agreed to reimburse the states for part of their expense in providing health insurance to people who were already eligible for public welfare benefits, for cash public welfare benefits, through like the Aid to Families for Dependent Children program. They offered this deal to the states. If they would be willing to cover their populations under Medicaid, the federal government would chip in part of the cost. And it took a long time for the states to agree to participate. Arizona didn't join the program until 1982. So this is a program that really started off by sort of supplementing the cash assistance that was being provided to people with health insurance.
And it was
now,
go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, go keep going. Go ahead. Interrupt me.
Right, I was going to ask is so just to make sure people understand, in contrast to Medicare, which is really a federal program through and through, Medicaid is really a sort of a supplement to individual state programs. Have I got that correct?
Exactly. It's a state. Well, the states had been running these programs. The states continue to run the programs. This is all up to the states to actually administer the programs, and they have to chip in some amount of matching money. The federal government matches the money that they provide. So that's how the program ran in its initiation. It was really about people who were eligible for cash assistance, what some social scientists call the deserving poor. And then, curiously, during the Reagan administration, there was a big expansion of the program to basically all children under 18 who were poor. So if you were a poor child, even if you lived in a two-parent household, you were eligible for Medicaid. And that's a big change in the program because it became effectively a universal program for poor children. Actually, even expanded to undocumented people for certain populations in that period during the Reagan administration. So we have this piece set up around cash assistance for people who are on welfare or on disability insurance. Then we've expanded it to kids. And then the Clinton administration comes along and it gets rid of welfare as we know it. So there's no more cash assistance program. They have to basically decouple that piece as well. So we're actually moving away from a program that's really tied to particular populations to a program that's more linked to people's incomes, to the poverty level. Several states in the 2000s expanded the coverage of their programs to all adults who were poor. That happened in a bunch of what we would say blue states in the early 2000s, most notably in Massachusetts under Romney. When Governor Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he expanded their state Medicaid program to cover all people in the state, all documented people in the state, I think, who had incomes under 100% of the federal poverty level. So no longer tying it to the kinds of populations that were eligible only through cash assistance. That's what the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, expanded on in expanding Medicaid. So they created the same thing as basically existed in Massachusetts, saying to states, expand your program to cover everyone who's poor, regardless of whether they're working or they're not working or they're disabled or they're a parent or whatever it is. If they're poor, they should be eligible for Medicaid. The ACA originally was written assuming that all states were going to be required to do this. The Supreme Court said no, states can choose whether or not they want to participate in the program. The federal match for the program was very generous. So over time, all but 10 states decided to participate in this expansion, and they have now expanded their Medicaid programs to cover everybody under effectively 138% of the federal poverty level who is documented in the United States and regardless of whether they have anything wrong with them. So that's the history of Medicaid.
And the last expansion, the one associated with the ACA, that has sort of created a significant increase in expenditures in the Medicaid program, has it not?
A lot less than people thought. It didn't the Medicaid program has not actually become very expensive. A curious thing about the ACA expansions is that actually Medicaid expenditures after the expansions were completed were less than had been anticipated before the expansion. So yeah, there's a lot of money being spent on the expansion population, but actually Medicaid costs are very well controlled. And so overall the program has been actually not that expensive.
Okay, so that sort of takes us to where we are in July. What is the anticipated difference in Medicaid spending at the federal level from what would have happened but for the so-called Big Beautiful Bill? How much savings does the so-called Big Beautiful Bill take out of the Medicaid program?
It takes about $1 trillion over the 10-year budget window, so that's a lot of money. And pretty much, you know, really focused on this population who were beneficiaries of the Affordable Care Act expansion.
Okay, so let's break it down. We have $1 trillion, and I think you just mentioned that one of the big pieces of it is this population. And the most talked about aspect in the press in recent weeks has been the so-called work requirement. Can you explain what the stated goals of the work requirement provisions are?
Well, it's a little hard to know exactly what the stated goals of the work requirement provision are. There are kind of two pieces of it. I think one is sort of a prescriptive goal. The idea is people ought to work, and maybe they're not working because they get a bunch of benefits even without working. So that would be the argument that says if we take those benefits away, they're likely to go to work. And so people who are able to work, they should be working. A second kind of argument is a sort of moral argument, I think. That's how I would read it, which says that people who aren't working just are not deserving of this program. So maybe it won't make them work, but they just don't deserve to be on it. The first piece, which is like the idea of tying benefits to work, is one that's been around for a long time. We've done it with SNAP, which is the food stamp program, for quite a long time. There's lots and lots of studies of this in the food stamp program, and basically they suggest that taking away people's food stamps for not working does not cause them to go to work. That's just not how people respond. Arkansas and Georgia tried to do the same thing with Medicaid. Now, if you think about it kind of from the perspective of an individual, Medicaid is an insurance program. It's really there for people when they get sick or if they need routine care. It's a little hard to imagine that people who are able to work and not working are going to go to work because they no longer have access to this insurance program, unless they have terribly serious health needs and are desperate to keep their coverage in that way. But then that population is probably not very able to work. So there's something a little bit funny to me about the logic here that says that a person who's not working, if you take away their health insurance, is likely to go to work. I think that's a pretty tenuous argument. In fact, the experience in Arkansas and Georgia was it did not lead people to go to work. I think there's just not a lot of evidence supporting the idea that this is going to lead people to work. That leaves open this sort of moral argument that, you know, people who don't work just should not, as a matter of like societal good, be getting benefits. That lazy people who can work shouldn't be getting Medicaid. I think the challenge there is that you're just not going to save a lot of money. we could go into that if you want.
No, and that is where I want to go, which is you had this recent article where you analyzed healthcare utilization and Medicaid spending under three categories of beneficiaries. Can you break that down for us? And what did that tell you about the likelihood of substantial savings arising from targeting this group of able-bodied, non-working individuals without vocational limitations?
Yeah, so the rhetoric around the work requirements is the sort of the archetypal person who keeps getting invoked as people are talking, advocates are talking about the work requirements, is a gamer living in the basement, you know, who's a lazy bum and isn't going to work, could be going to work, and instead spends their day playing video games. So the argument is that person should not be getting taxpayer-funded Medicaid. And one of the things that we did in this paper is look and see, well, how many people are there who kind of fit that profile of people who are not working but don't really have anything wrong with them that keeps them from working, and they're not looking after kids or doing any of those things. What do those people look like? How much Medicaid money do they actually spend? Well, if you think about that gamer in the basement, the answer is not a whole lot of money. People who are sitting in the basement playing video games are typically not people who are using a lot of healthcare. In fact, when we look at them, a lot of them don't use any Medicaid spending at all. They don't actually use care at all during the year. And even the ones who do spend a lot less than average. So if we look at how much money they spend on average in a year, it's at like $150. So you're not going to save a whole lot of money. And think about it. Like, young men in the basement playing video games, well, what medical services do they use? I even wonder to myself, how did they even get on Medicaid in the first place? Do you think of these as people who are so responsible that they bother getting themselves health insurance? And my best explanation of it is that their moms get them Medicaid, right? They just said, you know, you've got to have health insurance, son, and they signed them up. But they just don't spend a whole lot of money. And so that's not where you're going to get that $1 trillion from. That's just not a realistic source of the $1 trillion. So then where is the $1 trillion going to come from? It's really got to come from people who either are in the big population of Medicaid beneficiaries who are working. All estimates of the fraction of Medicaid beneficiaries without young kids and stuff who are working is that roughly at least half of them, 60%, 70%, depending on how you count it, are working. So there's lots of people there. You can actually find enough people that you can get quite a bit of money if you can get them off Medicaid. The problem is the law says those people are supposed to be allowed to stay on Medicaid. So there's a puzzler for you. How are they supposed, if they're supposed to stay on Medicaid, how are we going to get savings from them? Well, the answer is that this bill, the real way it works is not by trying to get people who are not working off Medicaid. It's by throwing enough obstacles in front of people who want to retain their Medicaid that even people who are supposed to be eligible for it drop off. So it's basically trying to get people who are responsible, who are working, who are doing all of those things, just making it such a pain in the neck to stay on Medicaid that some of them are going to drop off. The final group we look at, so there's the people who are actually working, meeting the work requirements, and there's just lots and lots of them, and so you're going to lose some fraction of them. You'll make some money that way for the federal budget. There are the people who are not working and report nothing is wrong with them, and they're just not spending any money. There's not a lot of money there. But the final group that I really worry about is people who are on Medicaid because there are things wrong with them, but they're not so bad that they actually qualify for SSI disability, or they just haven't gotten around to going through all the paperwork to get on disability. And in many ways, we don't want them to get on disability because what we know about people who get on disability is that they very rarely get off. So let's imagine a person who's just going through a spell of severe depression, for example. That would be a good example of somebody who is pretty disabled, probably not able to work, but isn't going to go out and qualify for income benefits, for disability income benefits. That's the kind of person for whom we'd really like them to stay on Medicaid, make sure they keep getting their meds and get better so that they can go back to work. They really do need Medicaid. They actually spend quite a lot of money in the Medicaid program. But they're going to have a really hard time dealing with the paperwork that is necessary to stay on Medicaid. They're going to need all sorts of certifications. They're going to have to get them renewed all the time. And if you think of the nature of that, a person like that, they have enough troubles in their life, many of them are likely to fall off. And this is what we actually saw when the Medicaid expansion happened in the first place. It actually picked up a lot of people who had mental health and substance use disorders that were not being effectively treated and finally got them into treatment.
So what did the experience in Arkansas, I know, what does that tell us about who is likely to lose coverage and why?
So what we learned in Arkansas is that people did not go back to work and that a lot of people lost coverage because the paperwork was such a hassle. The amount of money that was spent by the state to just administer the program dwarfed how much they were actually spending on people's services themselves. So instead of spending money on providing people with medical care, you spend money providing people with paperwork. Like you pay money, instead of paying money to doctors, you pay money to accountants and consulting companies to set up programs to check people's paperwork.
And to just
why this is desirable.
Yeah, and just throw obstacles in their way.
Just to throw obstacles in their way, right? Just to make them, you know, just think about it. You have to bring in copies. You have to find copies of your pay stubs. I don't know. I'm a pretty organized person. If I had to find all the documentation every 6 months to show that I had, in fact, worked 80 hours, blah, 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 it would be challenging even for me. And I have like a steady, steady job. If I was a low-income person who worked in multiple different jobs, right? If we think about the income streams of low-income people, this program, after all, is for people with incomes below 100% of the federal poverty level. So we're talking about people whose incomes are less than $15,000 a year. Those are typically going to be people who cobble together their income from many different positions. Mm-hmm. Probably some of them are not providing great documentation. You're not going to be able to call up the lawn mowing company that you worked for and get copies of your pay stubs, right? This is going to be a real hassle for those people.
Yeah, and a lot of people in that world are being paid through Venmo. And I don't know how they do
that. Yeah, are you going to like pause, right? Are states going to accept Venmo receipts?
Exactly.
I don't know.
So it's interesting. The burden, of course, will fall on the beneficiary to establish eligibility. This is going to be expensive for the states. Are the states going to be willing to throw enough resources into this to enable an efficient and effective system that allows, you know, people to qualify? That seems to me like a whole other set of barriers.
Absolutely. And one thing that we know is that states are going to differ considerably in their ability to do this. My guess is Massachusetts will do a very good job. They have almost everybody's enrolled in Medicaid. They have a very high-functioning state government. It's a pretty small state, they high income, right? So they'll put a lot of effort into this. There are low-income states that have expanded Medicaid, Missouri, say, right, where it's going to be really hard to come up with all that money to actually put the administrative pieces in place. You can just imagine the consulting companies salivating over this, right? The IT companies, we're going to set this thing up for you. It's going to be, it's just horrifying.
That's going to be a hell of a pitch.
Okay. Are there other sort of, you know, other requirements relating to establishing and maintaining eligibility that are likely to have significant effects? We've talked about the need to work requirement. The other one, I take it, is the frequency of establishing eligibility.
Right. So you're going to have to establish eligibility at least every 6 months. States have really been pushing towards making that period longer because I think one of the things that's really struck me in looking at the history of this program and changes in the world over time is that medical care has really, really changed a lot since 1965. And one of the ways it's changed a lot is that we do a lot better with meds than we used to do then. So there's lots of folks out there, we're talking about people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, who are taking, say, a statin and an antihypertensive med, right? Some just, you know, maybe even a GLP-1, but probably some diabetes 2 medications, metformin. These are meds that they need to be taking all the time, right? So you need to have continuity of care. And what we've learned over time is that actually going on and off these meds is really bad for you. So keeping people on coverage is really important. The more often you have to recertify, the more likely it is, even if you're a really stable person, really organized person, you're just going to miss one of those deadlines. Then your pills are going to end, right? You're not going to have them. You're not going to be able to make a visit to your doctor to get the pills, the prescriptions renewed. So there are real consequences, even of something as small as saying that people have to redetermine all the time.
Yeah. So now another major change relates to so-called provider taxes.
Yeah.
How do they work?
Yes. Well, this is a bit of a shenanigan that the states have had. I'm not supposed to use the word shenanigan, but it's a shenanigan. So remember that this is a federal matching program where the federal government matches the money that the states pay to providers. So over the years, and this has been going on, you know, since 1990, probably before that, states will impose a tax, say, on hospitals. And then they will raise the rates that they pay the hospital to cover the tax that they have levied on the hospital. The hospital will pay the tax to the state. The state will claim the full amount of the payment to the hospital for the federal match, right? And they will use the tax money that they were paid by the hospital to pay their share of the Medicaid cost. So they're pumping basically the federal Medicaid program for money. This is a bit of a, you know, it's creative accounting. And over the years, Congress and CMS have frequently tried to cut back on this, and they have successfully done so. There's a lot less of this than there used to be, but there are still states that rely heavily on these provider taxes to pay the state's share of Medicaid funding. So those states are now going to have to come up with new money to pay their share. And where are they going to find that money from? It's going to be challenging, and many of them are going to cut back in other ways. In their payments, maybe in their payment rates to hospitals, maybe in other things that they use the Medicaid program for, maybe in other ways to cut back on the spend. And because this bill is very much focused on that Obamacare expansion, the cutbacks are even more significant for states that have expanded Medicaid. So they're really limiting provider payment, provider taxes, particularly in those states. Now, that's going to put a lot of pressure on hospitals in those, both in the states that have and have not expanded Medicaid, because they rely very much on state Medicaid spending, especially hospitals in rural areas and hospitals in very poor urban areas. There's some money in the hospital in the bill for rural hospitals, but it's $50 billion. And remember, there's $1 trillion in cuts. So that's not going to go very far.
Do you think the savings are going to be realized?
That's a great question, and I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sort of optimistic that many states will figure out how to keep as many people on Medicaid as possible, and that the savings won't be realized. Maybe that's pessimistic. I don't know. You know, that technology has improved. It's improving all the time. We have AI and all those good things, and maybe we can actually, you know, make a deal with Venmo or something and try to keep people on their coverages, which, you know, I don't think Congress really cares. They just need the money because they have to get those tax cuts at least partially funded. So we'll see whether, you know, the game of the federal budget is that the Congressional Budget Office scores, that's called, you know, what it's called when they forecast the savings, they score a budget proposal. And that's what really matters. Nobody ever follows up to say, well, what did we actually save that money or not?
Yeah. Yeah. So now the net result of the various changes in this so-called big, beautiful bill is projected by experts to be a substantial increase in the uninsured in this country. What are, in your opinion, what are some of the likely impacts on things like emergency room utilization, mortality, costs of the emergency room?
Right. So some of the effect will be on emergency rooms, because people who aren't getting care elsewhere are going to wind up in the emergency room. I think that's not the main problem here. One problem will be that emergency rooms where people are getting care will not be paid anymore. So I'm not sure that there will be so much more use of emergency rooms, but more of the people who use emergency rooms will not be able to pay for the care that they receive there because they won't have Medicaid. So one of the effects of getting rid of Medicaid for all these people and having them show up in emergency rooms is that the hospitals and emergency rooms are going to have to go after them for collections to try and get money, to squeeze money out of them to pay their emergency room bills. One of the effects of the Affordable Care Act that's been pretty clearly shown is that it has reduced debt and bankruptcy among low-income people. We can expect that to go up again as they show up in the emergency room and can't pay their bills and go into collections. So definitely challenges in terms of not so much the utilization of emergency rooms, but the funding of hospitals and emergency rooms from people who show up there. There's now really very, very strong evidence, including from very conservative economists, that taking health insurance away from people is also likely to increase mortality. And the estimates are, you know, maybe over 10,000 deaths a year from people who are losing coverage from Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act marketplace subsidies that are also being slashed. And even more, we didn't talk about this, but there's also changes. There was a, this is kind of a funny change. The Biden administration had actually made it more possible for low-income Medicare beneficiaries, so low-income seniors, to enroll in Medicaid to cover their cost sharing and premiums in Medicare. That rule is going to go away. And so there'll be a lot of older people who will also not get the coverage that Medicaid provides to Medicare beneficiaries, which is really important, particularly for drug coverage. So yeah. There's also expected to be a lot of mortality from seniors who are no longer going to have adequate drug coverage. And as I said earlier, drug coverage has become such an important part of how we produce health that actually has big, big mortality effects as well. So people are going to die. People are going to die earlier, just to be very clear about this, right? Everyone is going to die. Many people are going to die sooner than would otherwise have been the case.
With that happy note, we're going to conclude our conversation with Dr. Sherry Gleed. Thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
You're very welcome.
College is expensive, and that's an understatement. There are numerous ways to pay for it, including having enough wealth that one can simply write a check, student loans, yikes, financial aid, and then there's a 529 college savings plan in which a parent, grandparent, or other will put away money for a child to be used in the future. Many states have their own plan, and we're lucky to have one of the top plans in the country right here in Utah. It's My 529, and we're lucky to be joined by their marketing director, Bryn Ramjouet. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
Exactly. So what exactly is a 529 and why should someone choose this for college instead of some of the other options?
It's always the place to start. So 529s have been around for about 30 years. They are a code in the IRS. It's code 529. That's where they get their name. They are built to incentivize and assist families in saving. The reasons that they are better than pulling from your retirement account or saving money in a regular savings account is you have the opportunity that that money is invested and the earnings on that investment are reinvested. So you get the advantage of compounding interest. The earnings are never taxed. So you're putting in your money from your paycheck that's already been taxed. That is your basis. Any earnings in the market, and you're looking at potentially an 18-year time horizon if you start when your children are born, your earnings are never taxed. The funds can be used anywhere in the United States. They can be used at schools abroad. There are lots of exit doors if your child chooses to do something else. The funds can be used for trade school, technical school, some beauty schools. The uses are super flexible. It can be used for room and board in addition to tuition, books, fees, the usual things. So lots of extra benefits that you wouldn't get from a traditional savings account.
Gotcha. Now, when you said it can be invested, is that... invested in a money market, stocks?
It's a great question. A lot of people, because we call them college savings accounts, people feel like they are just a savings account, but they're actually investment accounts. So you are putting your money in any 529, whether it's My 529 in Utah or a plan in another state, it is an investment. So you are subject to the rise and dips of the stock market. In Utah, we have over 14 different options. Some are conservative, some are aggressive. There's a commonality among plans that you have a kind of a glide path or age-based, and those get more conservative as your child gets closer to college-going age. And this gives comfort to some parents because they feel like their money is less at risk when they're going to need it.
Yeah, but then again, they also have 4 years of college. So if it's a If the market's down, they can, you know, for freshman year, they can always wait till junior year.
So you say there's 14 different options. Can you just take it one step deeper and say, what are the kinds of investments that My 529 offers?
What's on the menu? So there's a couple of FDIC options that are Sallie Mae, U.S. Bank. Those are going to be the lowest risk.
Sure.
There are dimensional funds, there are Vanguard funds. And one of the things that I don't think people also realize is that you're pooling your money with other savers. So you're actually getting the benefit of a, you're going to have to edit this because I'm not going to pull the word out of my memory bank.
We're live.
But it does allow for a different share class. So that is another advantage of saving. But the funds are like money market funds. They are not anything more exotic than what you would do with any other kind of investment. They're just in this specific code of college savings with those other benefits I spoke about.
Gotcha. So you did say it's so you make money in your salary, you pay your taxes, and then you put some of it into the My 529. Do you get a write-off on your taxes by putting that money in like you would with your IRA?
Yes, you do. So not all states have that. Utah does. So if you're a Utah resident paying Utah state taxes, you're going to have the additional benefit of a tax credit based on your contributions to the plan.
A state tax credit and a federal tax credit.
Well, the federal tax benefit is really that you're not paying taxes on the earnings when you use the money.
Okay, so from a state tax perspective, you're basically getting a double whammy, right? You're going to get a credit when you put it in, and you're not going to pay taxes when you take it out. From the federal perspective, all you get is the latter. You don't pay taxes when you take it out. Have I got that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. That is.
And again, you said they're like money market funds. I just to make sure we don't confuse people, some of them are like money market funds. Others are obviously invested in stocks. I assume some of them are index funds. So in that sense, they're not like money market funds in the sense that they're not, you know, rigid at a dollar plus interest. So, okay, what has been the historic experience with these plans? Have most of them shown a reasonable rate of return for the investors?
So on our website, you can look up the different funds and you can look at their 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year historical rate of return. So I think that is a tool that helps people make a choice. Mm-hmm. 529 plans are fiduciary, but they are not advisors. So you can't call our call center and say, which one should I pick? You're going to have to figure that out on your own. But we do offer the tools for you to do a lot of investigation. We also have a calculator so that you can say, I want my kid to go to Harvard and how much is that going to cost? Or I want my kid to go to Westminster College right here in Utah. What's that going to cost?
Speaking from bitter experience, I have to tell you that the calculators that I was using 20 years ago when I was saving for my child's college tuition were wildly inadequate because of the dramatic increase in the cost of college during that time. So I take it you guys don't have a crystal ball either. So that part's frustrating.
I think the calculators are better. I think that they can do just tuition. They can do the full loaded cost. If you have an idea of what college your kids may want them to go to, let's say, alma mater, you can go to that website and look at a fully loaded cost as well. So I think there are a lot of tools today to help guide us. I also think the more important tool is just to put some money away. It tells your kid, you've got options. I believe in you. You know, 18 years from now, the world could look totally different. It's going to be 2043. We're going to have three presidential elections between now and then. I think that education will look different. I think jobs will look different. I think the magic is put something away so that you're planning, hedging all your bets.
Now, just a moment ago, you mentioned your website. Can you let our listeners know what that website is.
www.my529.org. My529.org.
Wonderful. Now, it's Utah's version. Is this just for Utah residents, or can anyone in the country use it?
75% of our users, our customers, are from out of state. So only 25% of our customers are from Utah.
Yeah. So this is very popular. So what makes it so popular around the country?
What makes it so popular is that there is a rating system called Morningstar, and Morningstar is what we consider to be the gold standard of rating 529 plans. And My 529 has won gold more than any other plan in the country. So we've had 14 straight years of Morningstar gold. That's more straight years and more golds than any other plan. So we think we're doing pretty well.
You know, at one point, at least some 529s in specific states were offering almost a hedge your bet deal, which is if you put in a certain amount, they would guarantee it would cover tuition at the state university. Are any of them still doing that? And have you guys ever done that?
Well, I believe what you're talking about would be a prepaid tuition plan.
Right.
Very few still do it. There are, I think, two states that do it anymore. And what a deal if you got in on that early, right? You might have done yourself a very big favor, but it's hard to find those.
Yeah. So now, earlier you mentioned it can be used for room and board, as well as tuition. Anything else? Like before, let's say I have a daughter who's starting freshman year at the U. Buy a computer right now for her?
Oh, very interesting. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm going to probably guess. Here's the thing. Let me start over. The bill that was just passed adds some benefits, and the benefits that it adds are elementary and secondary school. It used to just cover some tuition for those schools. Now it is going to be able to cover materials, supplies, books, tuition, tutors, dual enrollment, some educational therapies. So that says to me that it now would allow you to buy that computer early. I would say that otherwise I would not be in line with the code unless my child was already enrolled in college.
Gotcha. Now, what about something like parking passes at a university, or nope, none of that stuff?
That transportation category is no-go. Ah. Will that change in 5 years, 10 years, 18 years? Probably. But right now, it's not going to cover your bus, your parking, a car, flights home for Thanksgiving. Just leave transportation off the table.
And just so we make sure we point this out, this is available to grandparents. And if a Utah grandparent were to write a check to a 529, would they get that tax credit even though it's not the child?
No, they would not.
Okay, so
if the grandparent is the account owner, that would change, but if a grandparent is putting money in an account like a gift, they're not going to get that tax credit.
Gotcha.
And
gotcha.
And does a gift to a 529 count against the annual gift credit exemption for tax purposes?
Yes, it would.
Okay.
And what is that? So I know you're allowed to front load a My 529. How much can they front load?
Ask me your question in a different way so that I understand it better.
So,
are you asking what the maximum contribution is? Like, if you want, what's the maximum contribution he could put
annually.
In today or annually? Let's start with today. Maximum contribution. I just had a kid. I want to fund the whole thing today because I'm having a good year. How much is the max I could put in?
I can't remember.
I think we stumped the expert.
I remember a few years ago, it was about 70,000. You can
the expert who's had one cup of coffee this morning. Well, so let's say it's $235,000.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Which I believe it is.
I think that's right.
So say $235,000, you can front load that. Absolutely. You can also do like a 5-year gifting if you're trying to do estate planning, yeah, where you can start at the end of the calendar year, load it up at the front end of the next calendar year, not make a contribution for additional years, and you're set. I think the other piece that you're talking about is, say you have a 529 account and you have some left over, leave it open. And then when there is a grandchild in the family or that college graduate has their own children, they are going to be able to start up with a fund that's already been growing and going.
Excellent. We just spent a few minutes with Brim Ramjouet of My529. Brim, thank you very much for your time and all that information for our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll be right back. Most car enthusiasts can identify a car driving by on a nearby road by its sound. The roar of the engine, maybe a little backfire on the downshift, maybe even a little gear grind while rapidly accelerating. If this sounds like you, perhaps you know or have heard of our next guest, co-founder of Warehouse Motor Club, Jake Wolf. He's here with us in studio to share Warehouse and maybe regale us with some stories from their recent rally to Colorado to play on the ice with supercars. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's get the mic right.
Okay.
Okay, there we go. So, real quick, what is Warehouse and when was it founded?
Yeah, so Warehouse is a private membership club speaking to enthusiasts, right? So a lot of people see it online, Warehouse Motor Club, and they say, oh, I have to be a car person, I have to be a car collector to be a member at Warehouse, and that's the exact opposite, actually. We have car collectors. Obviously, cars are kind of our anchor passion, but we're passionate about so much else. So when we created Warehouse, we wanted to create a physical space and then a community around it that celebrated all of our shared passions. So cars, art, watches, travel, events, food and dining. We do a ton of great culinary events. That's what we're really about, and try to share all those passions with our members.
So it's a country club kind of without a golf course.
Basically. Yeah. It's a clubhouse at a country club. Basically,
there you go.
Just centered around these passions.
But it is a very unique clubhouse. While when you go to a standard country club, you might see that the valets have parked maybe one or two recent Porsches in the front. When you go into the Warehouse, I want you to describe what it looks like, because it's quite something.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to describe. Pictures don't do it justice, and it looks good on pictures too, but You gotta see it to believe it. So we have 86 vehicles inside of the showroom, surrounded by art. They're on ground, they're also on lifts, and they actually come up through our club level, which is on the second floor, all glassed in, so you get this kind of crazy fishbowl effect. But we wanted anybody that came into the club to be able to appreciate the cars and the art that are on display. You don't have to be a car person to be wowed. Right? And I think we've done a great job of doing that.
What would be the wildest car that's in the Warehouse right now?
The wildest car that we have in Warehouse right now, what's awesome is our members really rotate their vehicles, which we encourage them to keep the showroom fresh, which is awesome. But we have two of the new Lamborghini Countaches based off of the iconic Lamborghini Countach from the 80s. And there's 112 in the world. There's 30 to 40 in the States. We have two of them. One is gold with gold wheels with a black and gold interior, which is absolutely amazing. It's uplifted into our club level right now, and it just looks crazy with our spotlighting on it. And then we have a white one with a red interior downstairs that's right next to an original 80s Countach. So you can see the differences. So I'm not aware of any other club that you can do that, let alone see two of them in the same place, club or dealership.
Yeah, that's, can the public just pop by and take a look at those?
We do, it's a private membership club, but we do public event once a quarter.
Oh.
And so usually it's a big open house. We open up the restaurant for everybody. And then, so we did one in April. We had Singer, who's a really high-end vehicle manufacturer out of California, that they make these bespoke Porsches, like millions of dollars. They brought some singers by, and we expected, you know, maybe 200 people, 300 people, and over 1,000 showed up. So it was really, really fun. It was a good, great chance for the community to come see the club. And we have a lot of fun doing those. So expect us to do something similar probably in September, October. We're planning right now.
So, Jake, you mentioned 80-some-odd cars that are currently in the facility. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the relationship between club members and the ability to put a car there. How does that work?
Yeah. So if you want to have a car there, first off, you reach out to us, and then you let us know what car you want to put in the place. If you go to warehouse, you'll see it's very curated in the collection that we have. It's not a this car is worth this amount of money versus this car isn't. I've always said if it brings a smile to our members' faces, that's what we're looking to get in the club. So that's kind of how our members approach us. But all those spaces are thankfully sold out, so we have a nice wait list, but we do have another warehouse down the road right now that we can accommodate through. But it's great, and you know, most of our members actually, this is another misconception about our club, we have about 181 members right now. Only about 64 have cars with us. So the majority of our club is people that want to be engaged in our community, want to have access to the clubhouse and our restaurant, which is really doing well lately. So it's cool to see the club flourish in that regard.
You know, I've been fortunate enough to have been on a couple of tours there, and one of the things that stunned me is you'd see this spectacular vehicle, and your people would explain a lot about its history and where it fits within, you know, the broader realm of things. And then you go to three cars later, and you go, it's owned by the same person. So you have several people that own multiple of these spectacular vehicles. These have got to be really serious car people.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we have multiple members with car collections over 20, 30, 40, 50, even 100 cars. So we have some pretty spectacular collections. When we first started selling pre-memberships in 2022, we allowed up to 5 cars, and that quickly went away. But there's a few that sneaked 5 cars and still have 5 cars in there. That if you go to the club, you'll see their names all over the floor.
And just so people can understand, the space we were talking about, the main warehouse space, is gorgeous and visible. The secondary space, is that more just a temperature-controlled, safe place for a vehicle, not so much of a showroom?
Exactly. It's non-customer-facing, secure, climate-controlled, all access to trickle chargers. So you get the same level of vehicle care that you'll get in warehouse. It's just down the road, and we come and grab your vehicle when you're ready for it. You just click a button in your app when you're ready to request it. We bring it over to the main club, and it's ready for you. So same level of experience, but also I can park your Sprinter van over in that building, which is pretty nice, which I probably wouldn't allow that in the main show.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that same question. If Kevin wants to come by and pick up his Lamborghini to take it for a spin, and it's 3 cars up on the lift, does he just give you guys notice and you get it ready for him?
Yes. Yeah. So the members just hit a button in the app, and there's actually a pretty funny YouTube video out there with a local YouTuber named Stradman, where he challenged one of our lot techs to get a car down off of the 4th rung, and he said he couldn't do it under 10 minutes, and we did it in 9 minutes, 30 seconds. So we just asked for an hour in advance, and it's pretty easy during regular business hours.
Now, are you a car collector yourself?
I am. I am a bit of one. So I don't have the pockets of my mm-hmm. members, but I have been very fortunate and lucky to get some pretty incredible deals. So I have a 1998 Lamborghini Diablo Monterey Edition, which mm-hmm. is one of 20. It's pretty funny. I have a car that was in an accident in the early 2000s and had a weird, like, it was an insurance fraud claim. And the guy put a new front end on it that looked wonky. And so I found this car for pretty cheap and then converted it back to its stock status. And it's really appreciated in value. And it's funny, mine's probably the worst of the 20. We have the nicest of the 20 at warehouse too. So you get to see both ends. But so I have that car that I love. And then kind of similarly, just picked up a Lamborghini LM002, Lamborghini Military 002. People don't realize they made a truck in the 80s, and a little bit of a restoration that I have to do on that one. The motor was not in the car when I bought it, but another another fun project for me. So I like the vintage stuff, and then my club car is Lamborghini Huracan Storado, which is featured in that ice rally, basically an off-road V10 supercar.
Nice, nice. Now, what's the car that got away from you? You were at an auction, you wanted the car, and someone outbid you. Is there any of those out there?
There's nothing like spectacular, I don't think. There's a lot of Ferrari 599s that I've not got. I love 599s. It's a V12 from like the late 2000s, and they were really cheap at one point. They're still pretty undervalued, I lost out on like five of them because I was just, you know, I was waiting for the right
right
to
price,
hit.
Yeah.
It never did. So.
Now, does the club have ancillary services? Like, do you have detailing? Do you have relationships with mechanics to help people get their car serviced, things like that?
Yep. Yeah. So on the vehicle side of our club, we just coordinate all your services. So we don't, other than starting your car once a month, we can check fluids. We do inspections when your car comes into the club, and then we re-inspect every quarter. Other than that, we just coordinate all your services for you. So we have great relationships with Ken Garf is a featured sponsor of ours, Porsche Salt Lake. Young Power Sports on the motorcycle side have been awesome to us. And then several little independent shops. Euro Planet down in Salt Lake is great for all of our vintage Ferraris. Mm. But we do have Lux Automotive on site, which is great. They're the best detailers we know of in Utah, and they just opened their location on our property in April, and they've just been crushing it. Their quality is amazing, and our members are loving it. The community's loving it. It's just bringing a whole other level of detailing services that Park City really never has had before.
So before we go, can you tell us a little bit about that last event in Colorado?
Yeah.
You mentioned your Hurricane was there.
Yeah. So every quarter we do a signature event, and that signature event is designed to be like a bucket list level experience. It's usually out of the state. So actually next week I'm flying 12 members out to Europe and doing a European rally. But this Colorado rally, we shut down a frozen lake in Georgetown, Colorado, and we were able to take our supercars out on the lake and do some rally course style drifting with a big rally all the way from Park City to Breckenridge, a ski day in Breckenridge. Really fun night there. And then next day was out on the ice and whipping around. We did a little member competition, which got a little heated, but very, very fun. There's a great video on our Instagram if you want to check it out. But that was an absolute blast.
And real quick, what is your website?
It's warehousemotorclub.com.
Excellent. Jake Wolf, Warehouse Motor Club. We'll be back in just a second.